Good evening, and thank you very much for coming out on a Motzei Shabbos for the topic of prenuptial agreements and the agreement for mutual respect. Too late? I heard that? Yeah. I am very grateful to Naomi and Zalman Goldman for agreeing to host tonight, for providing all the wonderful food that that everyone is enjoying, that I plan to take from after this year. Thank you so much. And I'm grateful as well to Eli Bienenstock and Pesach Goldman for, in general, being the organizers. Well, thank you. Organizers/coordinators for the Malava Malkas. This, I think, is our third year of having the Malava Malkas down south. Over the years, we've covered topics including gene editing and CRISPR, Tanakh study in Israel, medical care for terrorists, or dealing with neutralized terrorists. I forget exactly what that one was. It's been a lot of fun having these programs, and Eli and Pesach always do a great job of helping find hosts and helping to coordinate them in general. I also want to thank the members of the Beit Midrash who are here this evening. First of all, our Sgan, Rabbi Elihu Abbey, who's here with his wife Eliana, and they actually live in this part of the city, so it wasn't that big a schlep. Where is Azer?
Right here.
Oh, Azer Vienna, who is right here. Azer is from Clanton Park, but he now lives in Thornhill, because that can happen. And Rabbi Alex Hecht from New York, who is living in the Clanton Park area. I also want to make sure to note before we start this year, this flyer for a free program on December 25th. It is an all-day program of 30-minute shiurim on Tanakh. 30 minutes. Everyone hopefully can manage a 30-minute shiur. It starts at 9 a.m. It runs until 9 p.m. There is a free lunch. Let no one tell you there's no such thing as a free lunch. It is a light lunch, but it's a free lunch. And we conclude with an ice cream serum at 9 o'clock.
So okay, we can serve leftovers.
We can serve leftovers. There you go. We might get some fresh stuff also, but it's 10 heroes and 10 villains. Because the Beit Midrash is celebrating our 10th year here in Toronto. I cannot believe it is 10 years, but it is. So we picked out 10 heroes from Tanakh and 10 villains from Tanakh, and each of them is going to get a short shiur. It's going to be in our home-based medrash at Yeshivat Or Chaim. So I hope that people are able to make it. It's open to men, it's open to women, it's open to teenagers. Feel free. Okay. So the goal for tonight is indeed to discuss prenuptial agreements and one agreement in particular. What I want to do is introduce the issues that are involved in prenuptial agreements, which are meant ultimately to prevent the withholding of a get. That's really what it's about. I'm going to show how they play out in what many think of as sort of the classic halachic prenup. It's been in use since the early 90s, and that's from the Rabbinical Council of America. Then I'm going to take a slight detour to talk about why it doesn't work in Canada, and then move into Israel's rather unique Hesken LeKavod Hadadi, or Agreement for Mutual Respect, with its merits and flaws. Please note, first of all, we're aiming at like 45 minutes for this year, so this is an overview. I'm planning on giving a more intense shiur on it at some point in the future, but what we're doing tonight is going to be a summary of issues. And, of course, as always, Pesach is with your Rav. So I am not paskening anything at all, and please don't get me in trouble. Okay. What we're talking about begins with what is a very painful problem, and it pits two major issues against each other. On the one hand, the case of a marriage which, for whatever reason, has broken down, and where the woman wants to be able to remarry, and the husband at this point is not pursuing the marriage. It's not that he's saying we want counseling or whatever, but has moved out and is not interested in providing a get to his wife. That's the normal situation that results in this discussion about prenuptial agreements. The truth is, it can happen the other way. I was involved in a case in which a woman was refusing to accept the get. The more common one, and the one that the prenuptial agreements are generally designed to deal with, is the case in which the woman is unable to remarry because she's waiting on the get from her husband. And that's one side of this. And then the other side of this that makes things very difficult is fear of inappropriately declaring her free to marry when she's actually an Eish HaSish, when she's actually a married woman. Meaning, if a prenuptial agreement is done wrong, the get that's given through the prenuptial agreement is invalid, and therefore she is really still married, and therefore if she remarries, that's a violation of a Yehareg Bel Yavor, one of the most serious prohibitions in Judaism, and the children from that second marriage would end up being Mamzerim. So what you're dealing with is, on the one hand, everyone wanting to help her be able to get remarried, and then on the other hand, not wanting to do it in an inappropriate way. And that's what all of this plays out from. Clear? Okay. So, the problem begins with the fact that... I should note, there are more story sheets over here. I didn't translate the Hebrew on the sheets. That's not out of a desire to keep anything secret, but rather it's a desire of the fact of wanting to keep it to this number of pages, and the fact that given the time frame, I'm not going to go through most of the text inside anyway. So what I will go through, I'm going to say in English, and the text is here for people to have it, but I did not offer translations on it. So what we start with is the fact that halachically, either member of a couple is able to decline a get. Meaning, the way that the Torah frames the law of get in its very concise presentation is that the man gives the get to his wife, and it is of his own free will. He has to give it willingly. I brought you source number one in the Rambam from the very beginning of Hilchos Gerushin, in which the Rambam outlines what is required for a get to be valid, and the very first item that he puts into the... here, face up. There's a seat right here. The very first item that he requires in source number one is Shlo Yigaresha Ish Ela Beritzono. That it has to be willing. The get is invalid in the event that the man gives it unwillingly. So Mide Oraisa, already we see that the get has to be given with the man's willing consent. He actually has to be the one to give the get. And Mide Rabbanan, a woman cannot receive a get against her will. Meaning that if the man gives her the get and she is not a willing recipient, again, the get is invalid. So you require cooperation from both sides. There is an option that some may be familiar with. The option is called Kofen Oso Ad Sheyomar Rotza Ani. People have heard this phrase before. Kofen Oso Ad Sheyomar Rotza Ani means what?
Beat him up.
That's the way we usually render it. That's the translation. Literally, it means force him until he says, I am willing. Force him to do it until he says, you know, I think I actually am willing to do it. If you take a look at the Rambam, though, you find out that it's not quite that way. What the Rambam writes in source number two is, Mishadin nosein shakofen oso lagarish esishto v'lorotz lagarish. If, halachically, he is supposed to divorce his wife, because there are conditions that are outlined in halacha where we say, man, you have to give your woman, your wife a get. You can't stop. You can't withhold it. And he refuses. Then the Beis Din, wherever they are, makinoso ad shiomarotani. That's where the beat 'em up part starts. You get him to say, "I want to." And as the Rambam explains and the commentaries discuss, the idea is that he really does want to. He just has a yetzahara that's preventing him from acting, in the way that he wishes. So we're just providing him an incentive that balances out the yetzahara. And that way he will do what he really wanted to do in the first place. But the Rambam does believe in physical force to cause a get to be given. The Shach, others debate whether it's really true, whether physical force is indeed acceptable. The core idea, though, is that giving a get is fundamentally a mitzvah. It's not a mitzvah that we're all rushing to do, but to divorce via a get is actually a mitzvah, and we are compelling him to fulfill the mitzvah that is incumbent upon him. But here's the key. The Rambam began in source number two by saying it's only if there is a halachic obligation, if a Beis Din rules, if a court rules that he has to give a get, that's when kofen becomes an option. That's when compulsion becomes an option. Otherwise, compulsion doesn't help, and in fact will disqualify the get. So the question then is, what are you going to do when you have a man who's refusing to give the get, or again, for that matter, when a woman is refusing to receive the get? How do you get to the next stage? How do you get them to actually go through with it? So in my time when I was a shul rabbi, before coming here, I was involved in a few cases, and I found ways, Baruch Hashem, there were ways to deal with it. There was a fellow from who was an Israeli who refused to give his wife a get. So I called up his mother. It was about 7 p.m. my time. 2 a.m. her time, and I explained to her what he was doing, and 10 minutes later he was on the phone to me and agreed to give the get. There was another case where there was a woman who was refusing to receive the get, and I made as much of a nuisance of myself as you could possibly make trying to get her to agree to receive the get. And then when the husband suggested, you know, let's work with somebody besides Prochina, she said great, and she agreed to receive the get. There are all sorts of things that you can do, but none of these are ironclad. So what's been tried over the years has been to come up with agreements that would lead parties not to withhold a get. And again, generally these agreements have targeted the male. And the basic principle in all of them is the same, which is have them agree to an incentive which will be binding, but will not compel giving the get against one's will. So the two conditions in order for this to work is, number one, that this has to be binding, and that's tricky for a reason that we'll get to. And number two, it can't be a case of coercion. He has to have the option of not giving the get. If he's forced into it, if he's boxed in, he has no other options, then it's a coercion situation. And then some of the agreements had other agendas, as we'll see, but that's what you're going for. Something that is binding, but not coercing. I'm going to explain what that binding point is. We're going to come back to it in application, but I'll explain it now, and we'll see the application later. This is an issue called asmachta. Anyone familiar with the term asmachta? What does asmachta mean as it might apply here? Well, he means it, but he doesn't mean it. Asmachta means that a person enters into an agreement which they never expect to have to carry out. So to take it out of the divorce context, you accept a contract that says you're going to provide certain work for somebody. You say, I'm going to build you a house. And the person who you're contracting with says, that's wonderful, here's your deadline. What kind of penalty are you willing to accept if you don't deliver on time? And I say, well, you're paying me $1 million to build this house. I agree that in the event that I don't deliver it on time, it's free. I forfeit $1 million. Everybody knows I don't expect that to happen. I would never agree to anything that was that kind of a penalty unless I thought there's no way in the world this is going to happen, and this is the way I get to seal the deal. That's my incentive for entering into it. So this is what we call an asmachta. The person depends on himself, that this is never going to come to pass. And the problem with the prenup is the argument that, sure, they're right now about to get married, they're young and in love, they think, what could go wrong? And so he agrees to some term like what we're going to see that says that in the event that they're living apart and he's withholding a get, you know, he's going to have to pay her $150 a day or $1,500 a month, depending on which agreement you're talking about. So he says to himself, that's never going to happen. Sure, I'll sign the prenup and it makes him happy. Fine. But later on, he's going to say, I wasn't serious. I didn't think I was actually going to have to make good on this. And that's the asmachta concern, is that the argument will be this isn't really a binding agreement. So your basic attempt is to come up with an incentive that is binding, but it's not coercion. And again, we're going to see the application of this. This isn't a new idea. Out of curiosity, when do you think this sort of initiative started?
25 years ago.
500 years ago. Do I hear more? So the truth of the matter is that the modern prenup initiative starts in the 1940s, 1950s, in terms of agreements. that would be prenuptial. The RCA agreement, which is the I think the most popular one in use today, is 25 years old. It was actually in 1992, 93, 94 that it started out. But you find attempts to do this without a formal agreement before marriage going back to the 13th century. You already saw this back then. Rabbeinu Peretz, in the 13th century, in source number 3, talks about a case in which a man swears that he's going to give a get, and he says that it's valid so long as they do hataras nedarim. They have to repeal the oath before he gives it, lest the oath be considered coercion. He also talks about a man who gives an argos, who gives a collateral, and says, in the event that he won't give the get, he doesn't get the collateral back. If he gives the get, he gets the collateral in return. And Rabbeinu Peretz said, that's 100% fine. The Rashba dealt with a case in source number 4, which becomes very important in our discussion. You can see it there, but I'll say it outside. Reuven and Leah are married. Leah's relatives feel like this marriage has to end. And, excuse me, they come to an agreement with Reuven. They come to an agreement with Reuven that Reuven should in fact divorce Leah, and if he doesn't do it by a certain date, he's going to pay 1,000 dinarim. That's his agreement. And then he comes back to the Beis Din and says, I never intended to do that, I don't want to do it, it's coercion, and so on. But the Rashba, again, you're talking 13th century. Another one comes up in the 14th century, Rabbi Maimon Anuar, he's quoted in the Beis Yosef, I brought it here in source number 5. Similar financial issue. There was a fellow by the name of Reuven, and he had agreed that he would pay 100 gold coins to the local mayor if he doesn't divorce his wife. That question, interestingly, is put to Rabbi Maimon Neur by a Rabbi Menachem of Perpignan, and it is suspected that that's the Meiri who is sending him the Shaila, who's asking him this question. So what this means is the problem is not a new problem. The problem of the man's ability to withhold the get, or for that matter, her ability to refuse, although again, that's less dominant as a theme, is an old problem. And so the modern attempt is to try to come up with an agreement with which he will have to proceed, but again, the agreement has to walk a fine line such that it is binding and not coercive. Yeah.
Can you explain why it can't be coercive?
Why what?
Why can't it be coercive?
So that goes back to what we said about Kofin, which is that coercion is only acceptable if a Beis Din has given a psak that he has to give a get. If it's halachically determined that he's required to give a get. Meaning there are certain cases in which a man is actually required to do so. Most of the cases in which people want a divorce don't fit those parameters. Sorry? An example would be if he's incapable of relations with his wife. That would be an example of it. Okay. See, fast forward to the 20th century. In the 1950s, the conservative movement in the United States tries to amend the ketubah with what becomes known as the Lieberman Clause. Orthodoxy tended to reject tampering with the ketubah and prefers to have a separate document that's arranged before marriage. I'm not going into the issue of tampering with the ketubah. It's a fun discussion, but not for right now. Rav Bezalel Zsolti was the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim. Rav Shlomo Masas, or Mashash, was the chief rabbi of Morocco. Going back, very early on in this discussion, 50s, 60s, and they supported approaches which involved a financial payment from him to her, from the husband to the wife, in cases where halacha requires giving a get. So in the most narrow band of cases.
Wait, the husband has to give the wife money?
That in the event that he's failing to give the get, he's going to have to pay a certain sum. And the idea is that it's an incentive to get him to just go ahead and give the get. Exactly. In the early 1990s, Rabbi Mordechai Willig and the Rabbinical Council of America built on some earlier work by a dayan in Israel by the last name of Gartner and Rosalman Nehemiah Goldberg to come up with the first RCA prenuptial agreement, a version of which you'll see in number 6, we're going to get to it in a moment, in which they have two elements. Number one, the financial payment, but number two, very important, a binding arbitration agreement in which the couple says, again, they haven't even gotten married yet, they say that in the event that there's an issue, they're going to go to a particular Beis Din can be the RCA's Beis Din, doesn't have to be, but they name the Beis Din they're going to handle their get issues, as well as custody issues, financial issues, and so on. That's in operation from the early 90s, some variation of over time. And then in 2004, a group in Israel, led by Rabbi Yashiv Noel, Rabbi Dr. David Ben Sasson, and a woman who was a Tohenet Rabbanit, Rachel Levmor, they come up with what's called Heskem LeKavod Hadadi, the agreement for mutual respect, to address problems that they believe are unique to Israel. There's actually another one that's even more recent called the Tripartite Agreement, but I'm not going there. Let's get into the attempts via the prenups. If you take a look at source number 6, this is in English. Source number 6 is pulled off of the RCA's prenup website called theprenup.org. Very catchy, that. And I pulled a couple of clauses from this prenuptial agreement. The first part is the binding arbitration agreement. Should a dispute arise between the parties so that they do not live together as husband and wife, they agree to submit to binding arbitration before the Beth Din of America. That's the RCA's Beis Din. You can, on this document, actually get rid of that and put in whichever Beis Din you want, which shall have exclusive jurisdiction to decide all issues relating to a get, the ksuba, tznaim, entered into by the husband-to-be, the wife-to-be, any issues and obligations arising from or in connection with the agreement, any disputes relating to the enforceability, formation, cautionability, dot, 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 of the agreement. It's a binding arbitration agreement. This is immensely valuable, because what you find is many of the disputes between husband and wife surrounding divorce are not really about not wanting to get divorced, but about wanting to make sure they're not going to be taken advantage of by the other. And the fear, if I go where he wants to go, if I go where she wants to go, they picked that one because they felt they know somebody or it's going to be in their favor, or they know what they've done in previous cases. So this way, before they're ever married, they say, here's the Beis Din we're going to go to, if, God forbid, this ever becomes necessary. That's the idea. And this is not controversial, meaning this isn't the controversial part of a prenup. Rav Moshe Feinstein already said that this was valid to insert in the tznaim, right? The tznaim, which are otherwise useless in the way most people get married today, because people tend to fill them out the day of the marriage, and it says, we recognize that all of our issues have already been resolved, and we agree to go ahead with the marriage, and we're not going to back out. Thank you. You hired the videographer. You've got the flowers. Like, why did I think otherwise? But Rav Moshe Feinstein, if you jump for a second to source number 7, you can see it there, was asked whether you could add a clause in the tznaim which say that if, God forbid, they ever become to separation, the husband will not refuse to give it, the wife will not refuse to receive it, and that will be when a particular Beis Din orders that the get begin. So the question is, can you include that in the tznaim, knowing that now they'll be bound by this, as the Shaila continues, knowing the courts will enforce it? And he says that's mutter. And he says, again, lo yeh get me'usa, he says the get will not be considered a coerced get. That he is 100% fine with, although he does note one concern which people do mention, which is, you know, you have to be sensitive to the character of this young man and woman. Meaning, you have to suggest it in a proper way. You can't, you know, talk to people who are planning their lives together and are all excited about getting married in a way that is going to scare them off from marriage because of the way you're having this conversation. It's very important to know that the right person be the one to introduce this to them. For example, a parent of one of the parties should not be the one to suggest it to their child's intended. Generally speaking, it's a lot better if this comes from, let's say, the Rav, as an example. So that's and Rav Moshe says you have to be sensitive to the people themselves who are involved. But that's the binding arbitration agreement. That's one of those pieces that gets added. It's not core to the prenup, but it's really important, and it can help with avoiding problems. The other piece of this, going back to number 6, is the support obligation. And that's the key. Husband to be. husband-to-be acknowledges that he recites and accepts the following. I obligate myself to support my wife-to-be, it says by. That's interesting. I just cut and pasted it from the website. I'm going to have to let them know that they've got a typo. I obligate myself to support my wife-to-be according to the requirements of Jewish law governing Jewish husbands. Furthermore, I hereby now, me'ach shav, we'll come back to why that word matters, obligate myself in a manner that I cannot exempt myself with any claim of asmachta, that's what we talked about before, that it's not binding, or any other claim to support my wife-to-be from the date that our domestic residence together shall cease for whatever reasons, at the rate of $150 per day, this is US, about $7,000 Canadian, calculated as of the date of our marriage, adjusted annually by the Consumer Price Index, in lieu of my Jewish law obligation of support, as here and above cited and circumscribed, so long as the two of us remain married according to Jewish law, even if she has another source of income or earnings, which we're going to come back to. Furthermore, I waive my halachic rights to my wife's earnings for the period she's entitled to the above stipulated sum. And I recite that I shall be deemed to have repeated this waiver at the time of our wedding. Because you don't really want to do this on the day of the wedding. There are better times for this agreement to be taken care of. I acknowledge that I have now effected the above obligation by means of a kinyan in an esteemed beit din, we'll talk about that as well, as prescribed by Jewish law. However, the support obligation shall terminate if, despite husband-to-be's compliance, wife-to-be refuses to appear upon due notice. Furthermore, wife-to-be waives her right to collect any portion of this support obligation preceding the date of her reasonable attempt to provide written notification to the husband-to-be. In other words, if you didn't let him know, you can't collect support payments from him. That's not fair. If she's refusing to go to the Beit Din, again, it's not fair to collect something from him. And so on and so forth. You can you can see the rest of the text there and on the website. But what is suggested here is that he agrees to give her $150 a day as, if you noticed it in the text, I ran through it a little quickly, mizonot, as support. Meaning the ksuba already requires the husband to support his wife. That's not a novelty. What's new here?
It's per day.
It's per day.
There's a price.
There's a price. There's a dollar amount on it. The ksuba in Ashkenazi land, certainly, Sephardim tend to put more numbers in their ksuba, but the Ashkenazi ksuba does not tell you what the amount is. It just says you're going to have to support her. Not to mention, it's a high price. It's not unthinkable, but it's a high price. We stipulate a sum here. What this is modeled on is what Rabbeinu Peretz talked about in source number 3, which is the man is entitled to obligate himself financially, and it won't be considered coercion if the get is given on that basis. And it's brought in source number 8 in the Shulchan Aruch.
I have a question.
Yeah.
This may be strange, but because divorce is so prevalent in the outside community and it bled into the sort of Orthodox community,
okay,
and you have this prenup, isn't it just easier to get a get now with this? Not that I'm against this. This is great to protect women, and we need this. But wouldn't it be, isn't it just easier, like...
Yes. Yes, that's one of the standard opposition points that are brought up for prenups.
Don't forget your marriage. It's a tough go. And with this, you know what? I got the prenup. Screw you. I'm going.
In not so many words, that's what the post intended to say. That's one of the points that are raised in response is you're by removing an obstacle to divorce, you're also removing an incentive for them to work on the relationship. The response, though, that is usually given to it is this isn't an appropriate obstacle to divorce. The man's ability to withhold the get shouldn't be what induces them to go to counseling.
Agreed 100%, but because of the world we live in today, it's just sort of like the cell phone. Boom, you just press a button. Whereas, you know, in the old days, like, you know, a bit older, it's like you have to work for what's good. And here...
I hear you, but that's the debate.
I'm not against it.
Okay.
I want to ask a question related to $150. I signed this now, and I'm, you know, we're learning. right? And so our parents have, and then we get a divorce, and he doesn't have any money. So you can't get blood from a stone, right? So if he can't have any money, then he doesn't have to give the gift, because what are you going to do, take me to bankruptcy court? I don't have any money anyways.
Right, so we're going to come back to that as well. The also a valid point. Alan?
Isn't it also on the tuba, it's guaranteed you get to the silver?
Right, so Alan asks another important point. So we have three important points right now. One point is the fact that you remove the incentive, or some of the incentive, to work on things, for which, again, we discussed the different sides of that. The second point is, what if he doesn't have any assets?
Yeah.
Right? Now, this can be used to garnish wages. This can be used to go after him, you know, beyond this. But nonetheless, it's a valid point, and it becomes an issue in the Canada case that we're going to cover, which I hope to address also a little bit. The question of doesn't the ksuba already do this has indeed been raised, but there are a couple of problems with counting on the ksuba. One is that the ksuba is generally considered unenforceable in secular court. For a variety of reasons. One reason being no one knows what a zuz is. I had a fellow in my community in Pennsylvania who figured out what a zuz was. Because we know that what can you buy for two zuz? A young goat. Right, a lamb. So he went to a county fair and he found out how much it costs. And the answer was it was about $70, $70, $75 for a young goat. So he said, okay, so now do the math and you can figure out what 200 zuz are. But if the people who are entering into the contract don't know what they've agreed to, in addition to which there are other legal problems, like a lot of financial disclosure before the ksuba, but there are other problems to it as well. But it's a very hard document to actually enforce in any meaningful way. So that's one problem with using the ksuba. There are others which are going to come up in the course of the discussion. But let's get back to the to it, because there's an awful lot to talk about here. This is modeled on Mizonos. And as I was pointing to you in number 8, the Shulchan Aruch writes the following. If the husband swears that he's going to give a get, like we talked about in one of the cases, in Rabbeinu Peretz's case, so first you repeal it so that he can't claim he was coerced, and then have him give the get. And then the Ramah writes, also still in number 8, the same thing is true if he performed an act of kinyan, a formal act demonstrating that he's serious about divorcing her. But if he accepts a knas, if he accepts a fine on himself, if he doesn't go ahead and divorce her, lo mikri ones, that is not called compulsion. If he accepts a financial penalty for failure to give the get, that is not called compulsion. So he writes, so the Rama writes at first. However, if you keep on reading, he tells you that some are strict, and we're going to come back to the strict view as well. And ideally, he says what you should do is officially, formally exempt him from the fine before he gives the get, so that he can't claim afterwards that this was something he was coerced into doing. But if you didn't let him out, if you didn't release him from the commitment for the fine, the get is still valid retroactively because he wasn't forced to do it. Meaning he could always just pay up. He wasn't forced into it. So that's the basis for doing this and saying, well, it's really just an extension of the mizonos. And in fact, we have precedent for it. If anyone's familiar with the Sefer Nachlas Shiva, which is a landmark sefer on forms that are used in a beit din, he actually has a form like this for a chalitza case. To promise to go ahead with a chalitza, there are precedents for it. So it's not an asmachta. The reason this is not an asmachta, even though he'll say, "Well, I never planned that I was going to give it, that I was going to be even in this situation to divorce." Yeah, but you agreed to mizonos from the beginning. This is just your support obligation to your wife. You've been doing it all along. What do you mean you never expected to? Of course you did. You agreed to support her all along. That's what this is an extension of. And it's not compulsion. Any more than it would be compulsion for a man to say that he wants to give a get to avoid supporting his wife. Meaning, again, there's a basic obligation to support. A man comes to Beis Din and says he's going to give his wife a get because he can't handle supporting her. Forget any prenuptial agreements. That's his statement to the Beis Din. And then later he challenges it and says, well, that was really coercion. So the Chazon Ish already addressed this in source number 9. And he says, absolutely not. It's not called coercion if you're just trying to get out of support payments. So that's what the RCA comes up with as their system. Unfortunately, it does have pitfalls. If you agree to it as mizonos, number one, support is only an obligation so long as they're living together. Number two, the man's obligation to support his wife comes with a reciprocal entitlement to her income. So now what do you do? Is she really going to give up her income in order to be able to get this this money? So in terms of the support obligation ending if they're not living together, that's why if you go back to number six, they insert a specific clause. I'm just going to go ahead with this at this point. I want to make sure to explain this first.
I'm confused, though. The ketubah says that the woman has to reciprocate her money to the husband.
It's not mentioned in the ksuba. It's in the fine print. But the answer is yes. He's entitled to her income. It's a trade off.
Okay.
He has to support her, but he's entitled to the income. But I want to clarify that in a second. But first, I want to just clarify the business about them living together. It's specified in the prenuptial agreement that this obligation continues even if they are not living together. It's not contingent on them actually living together. That's number one. Number two, the business about being entitled to her income. So the Chelkas Mechokek, writing on the Shulchan Aruch, and I brought it on the sheet in sources 10 and 11, already notes that this doesn't apply to a woman who, as he puts it here, exerts herself especially to make a living. Which, he goes on to say, again in source number 11, applies to basically everybody from his day forward. The principle of Chalkas Mechokek says is, Kein Noagin B'Medinos Elu, in source number 11, Shalala Hotzi Miyada Isha Shum Ha'adafa Shalidei Adchak. The general principle is that women's income is not forfeited to the husband, having nothing to do with the prenup and having nothing to do with this agreement. But generally speaking, the man is not entitled to the money that she makes, but also she's able to make a condition. Right? She's able to make a condition in source number 12, in which she says, "I am not forfeiting my income by entering into this marriage." And you see it here. I brought it for you on the sheet in source number 12, but you also see it in the prenup itself, where it says, "Furthermore, I waive my halachic rights to my wife's earnings for the period that she is entitled to the above stipulated sum." So he says explicitly he's not claiming her income as part of the agreement. Pesach.
Isn't there a trade-off?
Yes. Go ahead.
I mean, the stipulation that he's entitled to her earnings is based on his ability or his requirements to provide.
Yes.
So can't she, I mean, the wife's not
trading,
like she trades her rights.
She is entitled to say, "I don't want to give up the income," and he's entitled to say, "Okay."
It's not any mizonos
then. Right. It's separate. It's a different point. Correct. It's not a trade-off of both. Correct. So that's one way to look at the financial penalty. The other way to look at the financial penalty is that it actually is a penalty. It's not pure mizonos. There's a concept in the Gemara, which I brought you from Bava Metzia Yud Beis Amud Beis in Source 13, but again, I'm not going to say it outside in the interest of time. But there's a concept of a woman who is in a position where she is divorced, but she's not divorced. Megureshes ve'ena megureshes. And it fits what we're talking about here. They're no longer living together, but on the other hand, she's not free to remarry. And the Gemara there posits that he would be obligated, if he is the obstacle, he would be obligated to pay her because he's keeping her from marrying somebody else. So effectively, he has to replace the support that she is not getting during this period of time. It's actually a penalty to him for preventing her from getting the mizono. So that's what Rav Zsolti, again, the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, puts forward as a potential solution to the problem. It's there in source number 14 on the sheet. He looks at it that way. The advantage to formulating it this way is that the penalty applies even if she has an income. It doesn't matter whether she has an income. It's actually a separate penalty. The disadvantage to it is that if it's a fine instead of mizonos, you're more likely to argue asmachta, that he never expected to be in this position. Mizonos, he expected to be in a position of supporting his wife. A fine, he never expected to pay. So that's the vulnerability of this.
What if he's not the obstacle to finalizing things? she has a whole bunch of things she wants to work out in the interim, which can sometimes be an issue. So why should he be penalized on a daily basis?
Right. So that, right. So that's where, going back to source number six, you have that last paragraph that I brought, that I, you know, that I sped read. The wife-to-be waives her right to collect any portion of this support obligation attributable to the period preceding the date of her reasonable attempt to provide written notification to the husband that she intends to collect the above sum. So that has to be there. But also, I should have gone back to the earlier line. This support obligation shall terminate if, despite husband-to-be's compliance with the terms of the agreement, wife-to-be refuses to appear upon due notice. So if she's not willing to show up in the basin and say, here I am, give me the get,
and if
then he has
to end up, well, okay, it's going to take more time than it should.
Then they can work that out. Yeah.
This seems from a practical point of view, I don't know if I think it would work, but I'm assuming if the couple is relatively well off and they get divorced, he'll probably be paying her $100,000 or more a year, which is more than $150 a day. So it's actually not no incentive whatsoever. I mean, if since we're writing numbers,
right?
Like these numbers don't really wouldn't scare most people actually.
I don't know. It'd scare me. The sorry. My wife is here for those who don't know.
I'm saying, like if you're making a few hundred thousand.
I will make an observation.
It's $750 a week.
Yeah, Shabbos counts.
I said $750 a week.
So it's even higher. So the answer to your question is this: you have a cap on what you can put in as a financial incentive. Because the higher you go with your incentive, the more vulnerable you are. First of all, it's no longer legitimate to claim that it's mizonos, that it's support.
It is legitimate.
That's number one. But number two, you're closer to the asmachta. You're closer to the guy who said, I'm forfeiting my $1 million. So you're walking a fine line. There are those who make the argument that Azer wanted to make, that this sounds high. But the response to that is, she's not just feeding herself out of his money. She's setting up a household, right? She's not living with him. So there is rent to pay, there are utility bills, there's other stuff going into this. So it's not as though the argument that it's high, I think, it depends on the society in which you live. But that's your problem, is you're trying to balance between this and you're relying on the idea that generally speaking, people don't like to pay money in a situation like this. Meaning, yeah, I wasn't going to say it that way, but yes. People don't like, as Mikey said, people don't like to pay money to people they don't like. He's offended by the fact that he has to make this payment at all, and he wants it done as soon as he can. I will say that the quote that I have heard repeatedly over the years is that they have yet to have a case in which a couple had signed this prenup, and he withheld the get.
But isn't this different than the money for the child support or the spousal support? Like, this is different than...
Correct.
Than the
this
money
is just the waiting on the get.
Right, so if, like, you're divorcing and you're getting $100,000 a year
separate.
Then it's $150 a day on top
yes.
of that.
No, well, until
he pays the get.
Correct. This is, you don't get time served. You can't count this towards, you know, the ultimate payment.
No. If she's the primary
voter, yeah.
Does he get?
He still has to pay.
It's a penalty.
Yeah.
With no income. Level.
Correct. Now, I'm looking at my recorder and recognizing that we're 40 minutes in, and I've got a lot of material left. So I'm gonna hold the questions for now, so we can get to some of the substance here. I will be glad to continue the conversation, but I want to make sure that we get to this. The asmachta solution, the way we deal with the problem of him claiming, I never expected to deal with this, goes back to some of the clauses you saw in number six, where the language was that he says, I am making it active me'achshav, from now. So it doesn't depend on what you were thinking later on. You're already obligated in this as of today, That's number one. And number two, it's what's done, as you see the language here, in an esteemed basin, a based in chashuv. And that's because we have precedent for accepting a deal that somebody agrees to, even if the language is extreme, even though it sounds like an asmachta, in the event that it is done effective today, as opposed to effective at some point in the future, and it's done with a kinyan in what's called, again, a Beis Din Chashuv, an esteemed Beis Din. Not everybody agrees to this. Rabbi J. David Bleich does not like this idea. But that's the way they deal with the Asmachta problem. And as far as the issue of coercion, so this is actually a fascinating debate, which we are going to sum up in a way that says it way too quickly, but again, for our purposes, I think it's appropriate. It goes back to two of those cases I mentioned in the beginning that go back to the 14th century, to the 13th century. The case of the Rashba in the 13th century and the case of Rabbi Neur, the Maimon Neur, and the question that was put to him, the cases of financial incentives. Rabbi Neur's psak on the case that was put to him where there was a financial incentive was that this is not considered to be coercion. And among the reasons why it's not coercion are, number one, he accepted the condition willingly. At the time, he said, I am happy to accept these terms. No, that's number one. Number two, it's not a commitment of, I am forced to give the get. It's, I am going to pay this money, unless I give the get. So it's not direct. He could just pay the money, in which case he doesn't have the get as an issue. And on that basis, Rabbi Neur says, this is okay. The Rashba, as noted, disagreed. There are some who try to read it that it's not a disagreement. I'm going to leave that for a more intensive shiur at another point. The Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, we saw already, said in fact, Rav Maimon is the law, Yesh Machmirim, some are strict like the Rashba. Rav Shlomo Amar in Israel argued that even the Rama would agree in our case where the goal is to prevent an aguna situation, that it would be, that even the Rashba would agree here. Others, of course, disagree. But those are your basic issues with prenups. Your issue is, did he really bind himself with this? And are you coercing him in this? There is also an overall discomfort with setting up marriages against a framework of how to end them. Right? That's a general objection. There's actually very strong language from Rav Gedaliah Axelrod, who was the Av Beis Din in Haifa, in source number 15, where he says, I'm not even sure you can call this kiddushin anymore. If at the time that they're getting together and they're going to get married, they're already deciding how they can best end the relationship, he believes that this, I mean, he's magzim a little bit, he's exaggerating a little bit. But he says it's inappropriate. Rav Chaim David Halevi, on the other hand, Rav Chaim David Halevi's response is ksuba, essentially. He's not, Rav Chaim David Halevi writing in the 50s was not talking about a prenup. He was talking about, not a halachic prenup, he was talking about financial prenups. And the question put to him was, is it appropriate to have a financial prenuptial agreement? He says, look at Shulchan Aruch. We have all these laws about what happens in disposition of assets and everything else. If you don't like the prenups, you also don't like, you know, all the dinim that we have, not to mention the ksuba. So he was not so bothered by it. Okay. But that's the basic prenup. Again, in Canada, none of this is useful, right? Anyone know why it's not useful? Sorry? Yes. No, the reason why it's not useful is because of a law in Canada that says that you can't go to religious courts to handle family law issues. As I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, it was because of fear of Sharia law. So therefore, everybody gets caught up in this net, and you can't, you know, an agreement that says we're going to go to a Beis Din to handle a divorce is not worth the paper it's written on. It's not effective. On the other hand, what you do have is a get law. For anyone who knows John Sirtash from Thornhill, he was involved as an architect of it, and he likes to discuss this. I brought you an excerpt from a paper of his on it in source number 17. And what the get law says, essentially, and this is my understanding, this is not legal advice, is that in the event that one of the parties to a marriage is preventing a divorce from going forward, they're not able to file any motion, offensive or defensive, in court. If they're obstructing it, saying, well, I don't want to give a get, and therefore she is now, if he's obstructing, he says, I'm not giving the get, and therefore she's unable to get remarried. So if she files for support, or she files for custody, or wants a change in an agreement, or whatever it is, he's not able to respond. Is that correct? Please, please, no, I'd rather have you say it, because you know what I'm talking about.
If she goes to the staff to try to get that kind of order, then
yes,
potentially.
Right. And that's a key point that I was going to address, is if she goes to that those steps. But that's the idea. The idea behind the get law is that it's supposed to essentially remove from him any ability to do anything in the divorce filing. And it's not considered ma'usa. It's not considered coercion. Because it's not taking something from him. You're not even demanding a fine. There's nothing. There's no payment from him. What you're doing is preventing him from acting. That's the idea. Yes?
The only thing I want to say is that there are wives try to do that, and there are rebuttal and try to say that is coercion.
Right.
You actually cannot go under this rule.
Right. So the idea of the GATT law is to try to avoid the coercion claim. The problem that we've seen, I wanted to show you source number 17, which is from John Sirtash's paper on it. The paper is not available popularly, but you can get it if you have access to one of the legal databases, and you can see it there. You can look it up. There are articles about it online. It does raise still the coercion question, according to some. Some are just uncomfortable with it in general. Broadly, without even giving a halachic explanation. And it does raise Erko's questions. It raises the question of, well, are you going to a secular court to handle a dispute between Jews?
It's still being enforceable in Beis Din.
Sorry?
Not enforceable in secular court. This prenup in Canada should still be enforceable if you cared about a Beis Din.
Right. But if you had someone who cared about a Beis Din, odds are this wouldn't be, you know, a problem.
It would be pushing back to the union. Yeah.
Yes. Unfortunately, though, the reality is that the cases that come up, they tend not to listen to the Beis Din either. I mean, one thing I will note on this, and then I'll take a question just because you're the hostess. But one thing that I will note is the major weakness. Even if you accept it halachically, and even if she's willing to go through the hoops, major weakness here is, what if you have a guy who doesn't care about seeing the kids? And who has no income that can be taken. Unless you say, well, that's an extreme case. I know of a case like that in Montreal. You have a case. He's willing to just, you know, okay, they'll take whatever I have. I don't have anything. Just in order to keep her from being able to remarry. So even if it works in an optimal way, even if everything is, if everyone's on board, you still have problem cases that it doesn't address.
So in the case of what you described, all she needs, why does she need more than the get? I understand that in Canada, you need to now go through divorce court. But there are plenty of Canadians that have all sorts of weird marriages, open marriages, and Canada has nothing wrong with this. So why can't I just take my get and continue my life, have a multiple, have a...
No, he's not giving the get. He's refusing to give a get.
Okay, yes.
Yeah.
But what we discussed before just now was that, in Canada specifically, it's not enough to go to the Jewish courts. You need to also...
I should say more clearly. What's required is not... The other pieces of this, including an agreement that says, in the event of separation, we're going to go to a Beit Din, is what a court will not uphold in Canada. That's the idea. Okay. The binding arbitration agreement is worthless. That brings us to our last point, which is this Israeli agreement, the Hiskem L'Chavod Hadadi. And I recognize if anyone does have to go, I'm okay with that. If anyone wants to go inside and refresh their food, I'm also okay with that. This agreement for mutual respect, I brought you in source number 18, excerpts of the key clauses. So the first thing to note, the first clause that I brought you in number 18 is the requirement of agreeing to go to marriage counseling. The notice recipient may request to rehabilitate them. The notice recipient means the one who received a petition to go ahead with divorce. So they may request, so let's say the wife says, I want a divorce, and the husband is now responding, he's allowed to say, I want to go to marriage counseling, with the help of a professional counselor accepted by both parties, and she agrees that this is part of their way of dealing with it.
Okay, so
that's number one. That's important, point number one. Point number two, the RCA one is dependent on a Beit Din saying to him, you have to come give a get. This one is not about Beit Din at all. This Israeli agreement does not necessarily have them go to a Beit Din. They can go to a secular Israeli court. Then what is it that triggers the obligation to divorce? 180 days since the time when one party requested a divorce of the other. Third part, you notice that the support agreement here is $1,500. It's $1,500 a month. Not $150 a day. It doesn't say per month here, but it is. Monthly maintenance payments. That's where it says it. So it's $1,500 a month. Maybe some like that more. Some people like that less. They again not dependent on her earnings. They go through the same steps of Kenyan, and it's from now. And then the last part, the bottom of the page. She obligates herself to pay him. In the event that she is the one obstructing the get, and that takes you on to the next side. So, what's particularly interesting to me in this agreement is not so much the prenup aspect of it, as the innovations that they make, which I think illustrate some of the pitfalls of innovation or some of the weaknesses of innovation. There's significant opposition to this agreement. And interestingly, it's across party lines or traditional, what you think of as party lines, meaning both in the Haredi community and in the Dati Leumi community, you find that there's opposition. Rabbi Eliezer Melamed, for those who are familiar with him, Rav Dov Lior, they are against it. So again, everyone wants her to be free to be able to remarry. That's not really the debate here. They don't want to enable a married woman to remarry. That's one of the things they'd like to avoid. But also there's an agenda issue here. The core prenup, meaning the financial payment, is built along the same lines as what you saw from the RCA, but with three key differences. Number one, you can go to a secular Israeli court to handle issues like assets, issues of custody. Those don't need to be handled in a Beit Din. Only an Israeli rabbinical court can handle divorce. That has nothing to do with a prenup. In Israel, rabbinical courts, for better or for worse, handle all issues of marriage and divorce. So what the authors of this prenup did was they said, you don't need a binding arbitration agreement to send them to a Beit Din in order to have a get, because it's all there anyway. They're not going anywhere else. They're going to a rabbinical court anyway. But what they also did was to say the non-get issues can be handled by the secular Israeli courts, and that's going to matter a great deal. The second difference is the 180-day period. And then the last issue is the tone of the document. The last difference is the tone of the document. I highlighted for you the counseling, right, the mandating of marital therapy, and number two, that the duties are placed upon both of them. It's not just about if he doesn't give it, he has to pay. If she doesn't accept it, she has to pay. What this document is trying to do is to address, well, what they say they're trying to do, I should say, is to address two problems. Number one is what's called a legal race, and what that means is the following. Generally speaking, when things are on the rocks, one of the spouses is going to say, you know, I think this is heading for divorce. I want to be the one to issue the notice first to appear in a Beit Din that I think is going to be favorable to me. And then the other one, knowing that's a possibility, thinks, well, I want to make sure to issue the notice. And the result can be that even when they're trying to work things out, they're doing this instead. And the result is they don't give the relationship a chance because they're racing to get to the court that they want to handle their assets, to handle the custody issues. So he thinks this Beit Din is going to help me on the assets. She thinks this secular court is going to help me on the assets. I think they'll give me a better deal. So in order to diffuse that, this system says, And I think I included the language in number 18, but if not, I included it in Dr. Liv Moore's article in number 19. What the document says is, we are going to accept standard Israeli law to handle disposition of assets and to handle custody. So therefore, it doesn't matter which court you go to, they're all going to handle it the same way. You follow?
Yeah.
Is that clear? That's to avoid the legal race, to try to get to a court that you think will be sympathetic. It won't matter. The other element of it that that they're trying to deal with is the problem of courts being unable to compel cooperation. So they say, well, we have an 880-day time frame, and any delay from either side is ultimately going to hurt them because they're going to have to pay this $1,500 a month. So that's what they're trying to solve in this with this document. They're trying to avoid the legal race, and they're trying to avoid the fact that courts can't compel cooperation. This way they're able to do it. So there are some who oppose this document on the same grounds that they would oppose any prenup. Meaning the argument that it's coercion, the argument that it's asmachta, the same old issues are brought out. There are also issues that are unique to Israel. Rabbi Dalia Axelrod notes in source number 20 that in Israel, if he refuses to give the get, he can go to jail. And even if you don't think fines constitute coercion, going to jail may constitute coercion. That's Rabbi Axelrod's concern about this. Frankly, that's not about this agreement, though. That's true in Israel, any get given in Israel, because the law is what requires that, not the prenup. The other argument, though, is Rabbi Melamed's argument in source number 21, where Rabbi Melamed says, if you're not going to say that you're going to Beit Din to resolve the custody issues, to resolve the financial issues, the result of this is going to be that you're going to a secular court. Secular courts, even if they're all populated by Jews, have the status of erkaot. Right? You're not supposed to go to secular courts. I've given a shiur on this before. Some of you were there. On the question of whether a Jew is allowed to go to secular courts for issues, under what circumstances a Jew is allowed to go to secular courts, that's its own discussion. Rabbi Melamed says, you're sending these right away to a secular court, and you're weakening the Beit Din system. And so that's another objection to the document. But what's particularly interesting to me, and this is my last point before I summarize, is the opposition that comes because this crosses certain red lines in Israel today. Meaning, the challenge to Batei Din. When Dr. Liv Moore writes her explanations for why they wrote the document this way, and I've read two of her essays explaining why they wrote it up, she plays down the decision to send the cases to secular courts, and what she doesn't mention is the elephant in the room, which is a sense in much of Israeli society that I'm not going to get a fair shake in a rabbinical court. They're biased. They're going to go on his side, on her side, because they're more religious. Issues like that. And so Rabbi Melamed is incensed. He says what you're doing with this agreement is you're feeding into the statement that a Beit Din is not to be trusted, that a Beit Din is not to be supported. People should go elsewhere. He's very upset. He says people are free to do what they want. They can choose to go to a Beit Din, not go to a Beit Din as they want. And he says, of course, we should be rooting out any judges who are, in fact, functioning inappropriately. He doesn't disagree with that, and he writes that explicitly. But he doesn't want an institutionalized document which formalizes in it, we don't care whether you go to a Beit Din, you go to anybody else, go wherever you want, and use Israeli law, general Israeli law, to handle your disputes. That is one of the reasons why there's opposition here. It is because of the challenge to the Batei Din. The other is because of the name of the agreement. The agreement for mutual respect, Hiskein LeKavod Hadadi. And that has a certain aura to it. When you title your prenup the agreement for mutual respect, it has a certain aura of, call it modernity, I suppose. But it triggers certain things for people. Rabbi Axelrod in number 23 says that this idea of Kavod Hadadi, he says that's Milat Zilzul Kineged Takanot Chazal. He says that is mocking, it is insulting the ksuba. Like the ksuba wasn't mutual respect, and now we are coming along in 2007, 2008, 2009, I forget the exact year, and we are going to institute mutual respect, because all these things the rabbis did beforehand didn't have mutual respect in them. Or as Rabbi Malamed notes, this document takes all the fault out of divorce. You want it? You get the divorce. There's no punishment. There's no penalty for whoever it is who's in the wrong in the in this whole thing. If somebody is walking out on a marriage, the couple, as he writes, has invested in the marriage. The husband invested in the marriage. The wife invested in the marriage. And now suddenly one partner says, "You know what? I just want out. I like somebody else. I'm not interested anymore." So there's no penalty to them for it. So if you look at Rabbi Malamed's language in 22, this is worth seeing inside. He says, "Efshar lomar." He says it's possible to say, "Shema'achareya ti'un she'ein ashem," behind the claim that there is no fault, "O she'tamid shnei tzadim ashemim b'shaveh," or that both sides are always equally at fault, "Mistateret fisat olam postmodernit." He says there's a postmodern philosophy behind that. "Shalafiha kol achad yesh ha'emet shalo," that everyone has their truth, and that you can't, and that therefore there's no way to assign blame. He doesn't like that. You can hear in his language how offended he is by that. So what you get in this situation is a prenup that's trying to deal with certain issues that are unique to Israel, specifically the fact that they don't have to go to a Beis Din in order for this to work, and the problem of the legal race to try to get to whichever system you think is going to help you. That's what it's trying to avoid. However, by playing in addition the element of, we want to make sure they go to counseling, and calling it a document of mutual respect, they raised certain opposition that they otherwise would not have had. So to summarize everything that we've said in the last hour, in a minute, the core problem everybody understands. We want her to be able to remarry. We want to avoid marrying off someone who's already married, and mamzerus issues. We want the both parties to be willing to do it. And in particular, the concern is for the guy. So we create a financial incentive, which is, number one, binding, and number two, not considered coercion, as was tried postnuptially going back to the 13th, 14th centuries. The RCA prenup tries to do that with their financial payment plus the binding arbitration agreement, which specifies the rabbinical court to handle their issues. Israel's agreement drops the imperative to go to Beit Din, adds in an imperative for marital therapy, and the avoidance of Beit Din, as well as this progressive tone, earns it opposition even from those who would have accepted the basic idea of a financial incentive. That's in a nutshell what we covered. I thank you very much for your patience. I reiterate again, Sock is with your Rav. I'm not posketing anything for anybody, but those who are getting married, those whose children are getting married, should certainly look into this with the Rav in order to figure out what is ideal. I'm going to stay to discuss things. We can actually, let's try this. Anyone who wants to go back and eat should take food. Anyone who wants to leave should be able to leave. But anyone who wants to be able to continue it, I'll stand here and we can keep doing that as long as...
We can literally shuffle us right after.
Thanks.